All at once, she raised her hand in the gesture that means, "Stop," and then motioned to indicate that he should move away from the doorway. In a hushed voice, she said, "The most important thing you can do for my husband is stay nearby and keep an eye on him, and help him if he wants to move around or take a shower or whatever. He has his moods. Right now he's pretty low. He doesn't want to move at all, not even for therapy. But he's headstrong. The next thing you know, he's going to want to go charging up and down the stairs. The stairs and the shower are what worry me most. I don't want him to fall. Right now he doesn't even have access to a shower. I told him not to set up a bed in the library. There's no shower and no tub down here. But he's headstrong. If he hasn't changed his mind by this evening, I'll be surprised." "I see," said Conrad. He was very much aware of the young woman's perfume. "One other thing," she said. "If he gets obstreperous and tries to do something foolish, bark at him. That's the only thing he'll pay attention to. There's no use trying logical persuasion." "I'll do my best," said Conrad. Somehow he didn't dare look her in the eye. He kept his gaze on the zone of her mouth and her nose. She beckoned him back to the doorway. Everywhere you looked, stately, lugubrious panels, shelves and moldings of mahogany, and matching leather-bound books that seemed to have been bought by the yard. There was an enormous waist-high globe, supported by a dark wooden cradle, inlaid with some other kind of wood that was lighter. In the next instant, Conrad saw the bed, set up awkwardly in the middle of the room. Only then did he see the big old man. He was slumped back in a leather easy chair. The old man didn't even look at him until his young wife went over to him and said, "Charlie, here's the young man from the Carter people. You remember that? He's come to help out." Then she looked at Conrad in a rather anxious way. It took a moment before he realized that she hadn't caught his name. "I'm Connie DeCasse, Mr. Crooker," he said. "But please call me Connie." Nothing. The old man was staring between his knees at the floor, apparently thinking of something unpleasant and 1,000 miles away. Conrad thought he must be senile. But then he looked up slowly and said, "Well, Connie, I'm going to bed. Maybe you can help me with that."
"Certainly."
"Please, Charlie," said his wife, "don't just go from a bed in the hospital to a bed here. You're supposed to exercise your knee. You know that."
"I know something else, too. I'm tired." Came out closer to tarred than tired.
"Well, I'm afraid my husband's in a mood to be difficult, Connie. I wish you luck." She tried to make it light without succeeding 100%.
"Who's had the knee operation around here?" said Charlie Croker, also with the pretense of keeping it light, although anybody could see how much he was fuming.
Serena Croker departed the room, and now there were just the two of them.
"Help me up out of this chair, son," said the old man. "This knee of mine hurts like a son of a bitch."
"Which knee is it?" asked Conrad.
"The right one."
"Okay," said Conrad, standing to the old man's left. "I'm going to put both hands under this arm," the old man's left arm, "and you take hold of my arm here." Conrad indicated his left forearm, "with your other hand, and on three we'll both pull up." The old man hooked his hand over Conrad's forearm, and then Conrad said, "One, two, three." The old man rose, wincing in pain from the stiffness of his knee. Conrad supported him until he got his balance, and then he said, "Put your arm around my shoulder. That'll take the weight off your right leg, and we'll walk over to the bed," which was all of three steps away. As the old man leaned against Conrad and hobbled, he said,
"I didn't think you could do it."
"Do what, sir?"
"Pull me up. I weigh 235 pounds. You must have a lot of arm strength."
"You did half the pulling, Mr. Croker. Don't forget that."
With considerable puffing and groaning, plus Conrad's help, Mr. Croker managed to get into bed. He sighed profoundly and sank back into the pillow with his chin up in the air.
"Sir," said Conrad, "you want me to bring you the newspaper or anything?"
A long, drawn-out, "No."
The old man's eyes were closed. Conrad had no idea how little interest a depressed man has in the daily newspaper.
"Well, I'll be here when you need me, Mr. Croker," said Conrad.
No reply.
Conrad sat down in a straight-backed chair near the doorway, where he could steal enough light from the entry gallery to read, and opened the Stoics. Epictetus says, "Your poor body, then, is it slavish or free?" One of his students says,
"We know not."
"Do you not know that it is a slave to fever, gout, ophthalmia, dysentery, the tyrant, fire, sword, everything stronger than itself?"
"Yes, it is a slave."
"How, then, can any part of the body be still free from hindrance? How can that which is naturally dead, earth and clay, be great or precious? What then? Have you no element of freedom?"
"Perhaps none."
"Why? Who can compel you to assent to what appears false?"
"No one."
"And who to refuse assent to what appears true?"
"No one."
"Here, too, then, you have free and unhindered action. Miserable men, develop this. Set your minds on this. Seek your good here."
Conrad cast a glance at old Mr. Croker. He would love to read to him what he had just read. The body, a slave to all sorts of things, including surgeons and their knives. How can that which is naturally dead, earth and clay, be great or precious? But he would resist that impulse. What could the wisdom of Epictetus possibly mean to a hard-bitten old real estate developer? Charlie opened his eyes into slits just big enough to survey the library and make out its occupants. Serena was gone. Good. Nina and Jermaine were gone. Also good. Only the boy from the home care service was here. That was fine. The boy didn't know him and had no way of passing judgment on him for not being himself. The boy was sitting close to the doorway, bathed by the light from the hall, reading a book. What a pair of arms the kid has! His forearms are huge. His forearms and his hands. Kid pulled me right up out of the chair. What a time it is when you're that age. What, 20? 21? And you can build yourself up like an ox, like a Jersey bull. But this kid, he doesn't look like a bodybuilder. He looks like he got his muscles from work. What's that on the ring finger of his left hand? Like a crevice. Something really bit into the flesh. A ring? A wedding ring? What's it matter? It don't matter. He's polite, and he don't riddle you with questions. Charlie was curious in spite of himself. What brought a young man to a job like this? He turned his head toward the boy, opened his eyes, and said, "Well, what are you reading?" "Sir?" The boy looked startled and closed the book.
"What are you reading?"
His voice was so tired.
"It's a book called The Stoics, Mr. Croker."
I see. What's it about?
It's everything the Stoic philosophers wrote, or everything they said that was written down by other people. Both.
Is it interesting?
It is to me, Mr. Croker.
What's the interesting part?
Well, most philosophies, or from what I know about them, and I don't know much, Mr. Croker. Sure you want me to go into all this?
Yeah. Tell me what makes it interesting.
Charlie managed to shift his bulk and prop his head up against the headboard, so he wouldn't be talking from out of a pillow.
Well, said the boy, most philosophies assume that you're free, that you've got all these possibilities, and it's like you can design your own life any way you want.
The boy hesitated, so Charlie gave him a little encouragement.
Go ahead.
Well, the Stoics, they assumed the opposite. They said that, in fact, you have very few choices. You're probably trapped in some situation. Everything from being under somebody's thumb to being a slave to disease to actually being in jail. They assumed that, in all likelihood, you weren't free.
What were they? Said Charlie. Greeks?
They were Romans, said the boy. Although one of them, Epictetus, was a Greek living in Rome.
When was all this?
About the time of Nero, the 1st century A.D. What stuck in Charlie's mind was probably trapped in some situation.
So, tell me, do you consider yourself a Stoic?
I'm just reading about it, said Conrad. But I wish there was somebody around today, somebody you could go to, the way students went to Epictetus. Today people think of Stoics like, you know, like they're people who grit their teeth and tolerate pain and suffering. But that's not it at all. What they are is, they're serene and confident in the face of anything you can throw at them. If you say to a Stoic, "Look, you do what I tell you or I'll kill you," he'll look you in the eye and say, "You do what you have to do, and I'll do what I have to do. And, by the way, when did I ever tell you I was immortal?"
"And you'd like to be like that?" asked Charlie.
Yes. Charlie could tell that the boy felt he had already said too much.
"All right," said Charlie. "Let's suppose somebody is in a dilemma. If he chooses one thing, then he gains something valuable, but he loses something that may be even more valuable. And vice versa. If he chooses the other thing, then it's the same problem. He gains one thing of value and loses another thing that may be even more valuable. What does your Stoic say to that?"
"Well, for him, the Stoic... Are you sure I'm not telling you more about Stoicism than you want to know? Honest, I'm not a nut on the subject. I just happen to be reading about it."
"No, no, no," said Charlie. "Please, go ahead. You can be sure it's a hell of a lot more interesting than listening to lectures about knee replacements and being a good patient and how important it is to do your therapy. They're the ones who tell you to just grit your teeth and take it, which is easy for them to say. So what does your Stoic say about dilemmas?"
There was embarrassment on the boy's face. He hesitated, then said, "To a Stoic, there are no dilemmas. They don't exist."
"How can they not exist?"
"I'll try to give you an example, Mr. Croker. Are you sure you don't mind hearing all this?"
"No, go ahead. I'm interested."
The boy said, "Well, there was a famous Stoic named Agrippinus, if that's the way you pronounce it. I've never heard anybody say his name out loud. Anyway, one day, this was in Rome at the time Nero was the emperor, about 95 A.D.,
Nero loved to humiliate prominent Romans by ordering them to put on costumes and make fools of themselves in these plays he used to write. So one day this well-known Roman historian named Florus arrives at Agrippina's house, and he's sweating and trembling, and he says to Agrippina, "The most terrible thing has happened. I've been summoned to appear in one of Nero's plays. If I do it, I'll be humiliated before everybody in Rome that I care about. If I don't, I'll be killed." "I've received the same summons," says Agrippina. "My God," says the historian, "you too? What do we do?" "You go ahead and act in the play," said Agrippina. "I'm not going to." "Why me and not you?" said the historian. "Because you've considered it."
"Christ almighty," said Charlie, "that's—"
But he decided not to finish the thought. "I can give you another example from Epictetus' own life."
"Good,"
said Charlie. "But if I'm rattling on too long," said the boy, "you've got to say so."
"No, this interests me."
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure. Go ahead."
"Well, the emperor after Nero was Domitian. And the way he looked at it, the philosophers, particularly the Stoics, were good for nothing but stirring up trouble. So he issued an ultimatum. All the Roman philosophers either had to cut off their beards— the long beards were the emblem, I guess you'd say, of the philosopher. You either cut off your beard, which was like saying, "I renounce being a philosopher," or "we'll kill you and send you into exile." A delegation from the emperor comes around to deliver the ultimatum to Epictetus, and he doesn't even say, "Let me think it over." He says, right on the spot, "I'm not removing my beard." And they say, "Then we'll execute you." Epictetus laughs and says, "Are you talking about this vessel of clay and its quart of blood that is my body? Go ahead. I've only got it on loan for a little while anyway."
"Okay," said Charlie. "So what happened to them, Epiteter?"
"Epictetus."
"And Agrippus?"
"Agrippinus."
"Two brave men who say fuck you to the authorities. What happened to them?"
"It's interesting," said the boy. "Or I think it is. Both resisted the authorities head on, with no negotiation. And neither one of them was executed. Both of them were exiled, which was a terrible punishment in those days. But nobody—I'm only guessing, of course—nobody wanted the death of such powerful spirits on their hands." Charlie lay there for a moment, trying to fit all this into his situation. Suppose he just said, "fuck you," to everybody who was putting the squeeze on him—the bank, Farik Fanon's lawyer. What would be the outcome? All he could see as the realistic answer to that question was utter desolation. A disgraced Cap'n Charlie with no one to follow his commands. And yet he wanted to know more.
"Well, let me ask you something, Connie."
Suddenly Serena was back in the room. Flustered, she closed the library door and hurried past the boy, Connie, and over to Charlie's bed. "Charlie," she said, "are you all right?"
"Yeah, I guess," said Charlie.
"Charlie, there's this man who keeps calling. He says he's a lawyer, and he insists he has to see you. His name is—"
"Roger White,"
said Charlie in a weary voice.
"Oh, that's it.
What do I tell him?"
"Don't tell him anything. Let Jarmaine answer the telephone."
"All right," said Serena with a distracted air. "But he kept saying he had to have an answer from you very soon. That's what he kept saying over and over." "An answer about what, Charlie?"
"He's a lawyer," said Charlie. "He wants me to testify in some case of his."
"What kind of case?"
"Oh, it doesn't matter," said Charlie. He tried to sink deeper, deeper, and yet deeper
into the bed. Chapter 30 The Bull and the Lion. Peepgas leaned way back in the chair to give himself enough room between his abdomen and the table to rustle back the first section of the Journal Constitution from page 1 to page 12. Much rustle, rustle, rustling of the newspaper, so he could continue reading about the latest developments in the case of Farik Fannin and the as-yet-unnamed-in-print Elizabeth Armholster. In the midst of the big foldback, he happened to glance out the window. He couldn't believe it. There was the gardener, Franklin, down on his knees, edging the flower-bed with a trowel. Where had he come from? 5 minutes ago he wasn't there. Peepgas hadn't seen him arrive and hadn't heard him arrive. Even though the window was wide open and Franklin was no more than 12 feet away from him. Martha had opened the window because it was such a nice cool morning you didn't need the air conditioning. It was as if Franklin had grown up from out of the earth like a tuber in his earth-colored work shirt and vest and his earth-colored skin, when neither Peepgas nor Martha was paying attention. Martha looked up from the part of the Journal Constitution she was reading, Section E, called Horizon. The newspaper's euphemism, Peepgas thought ruefully, for the suburbs. Particularly poor old basketball backboard and hoop-in-the-driveway commuter burbs, like Snellville. Martha looked up and smiled and asked,
"What on earth is that headline about Fannin's cannons supposed to mean?"
"Well, it's here," said Peepgas, extending the first section toward her. "Take a look. It's interesting. Politics is rearing its mangy head."
"No, no, no," said Martha. "I don't want to read it right now. I was just hoping it wasn't a double entendre."
"I don't think the Journal Constitution goes in for double entendres, or at least not racy ones. That's R-A-C-Y, not R-A-C-E-Y."
"Is R-A-C-E-Y a word?"
"Please, don't get technical on me. It seems that they've—I'm not really sure who they are. They've started a defense fund for Farik Fannin, and a couple of black councilmen are saying that the whole thing is—you'll never guess what—a racist plot to discredit Fannin. They're his cannons, the councilmen. It's become very political. The mayor has announced he'll be holding a press conference and making a major statement about the whole thing." That was what Peepgas was saying as he looked toward Martha across this elegant round mahogany table with fruitwood banding, a swarm with hand-crocheted placemats, and a veritable flotilla of silver and crystal, including a silver bread gondola, with a damask napkin lining it, currently empty because Peepgas had devoured every last morsel of the toasted Sally Lunn that had been therein, along with his scrambled eggs, grits, hot country sausage, and New Orleans coffee. But what he was thinking was, "Does she look any better this morning? What could she do about that thickness in the neck and shoulders and upper back? Anything? Probably not. Would she be presentable? I'm only 46. She's 53. Would it be embarrassing to take her places as my wife? She does have fabulous legs, but is there some kind of regimen or diet to get rid of that thickness up top? What happens when she's 60 and I'm only 53? What then? On the other hand, look at what's all around me here. This is Buckhead, the real thoroughbred Buckhead. Look at this house. Look at that yard. Look at that faithful old Franklin. Look at what's on this table. Enough silver to make a down payment on a four-bedroom house in Snellville. Poor old Snellville. Jesus Christ, if Syria wins her goddamned paternity suit, which no doubt she will, and I have to pay Christ knows how much in support payments, I'll be flat as a flounder. Pietari paivarinta Peepgas. Pavi, pavi, pavi. Little Pavi will get bigger and bigger. He'll eat and eat and eat, thanks to me being squeezed every month like a tube of old toothpaste, for the next 18 years. I'll be an old man waiting to get the Crystal Phoenix from Planner's Bank before it all ends. I won't have lived, for Christ's sake."
He looked at Martha again, as if he were about to say something more about the Elizabeth Armholster business. But in fact, he was studying her and thinking, "She's actually pretty. Not too many lines. Nice hair. Full. Dyed. Can't tell. Has all her makeup on, even at breakfast. Simple, stylish cotton dress. Navy with vertical white stripes. High in the hem to show off those legs. But that neck. Thick. Chunky gold chain for a necklace. Casual, but must be a ton of gold in the damn thing. Syria. Destroying him as if she's God's avenging angel. Kept thinking of Syria last night. Only way he could get it done, wasn't it? A vision of Syria the way she was that very first night at the Grand Totter. She had stripped down to her stockings, the old-fashioned kind, not pantyhose. Medium brown sheer nylon stockings they were, held up by old-fashioned garters with flowery little yellow and mint-green bows on them. That was all she had on. Not a stitch more. At first she was standing in the hotel room with only the stockings on, and then she had put one foot up on a chair and tipped her vulva toward him. The labiae were red, red with lust. She put her forefinger and her middle finger in her mouth, and then took them out and stroked her labiae, while her hooters bulged and bulged and bulged with lubricity, and her face. But he had purposely blanked out her face, cut off her head, in his emergency recollection, because the face was the outer mask of her vile and treacherous mind. But he needed those loins of hers, had to bring them alive in his imagination, or he couldn't have managed to get it done with Martha here, who's so thick through the shoulders. Would he have to think of a beheaded Syria Tiramaki, mother of Pietari Paivarinta Peepgas, every time, from now on? No use dwelling on that. They were both embarrassed when they got up this morning. What do you say to her at her age? Or his age, for that matter. His clothes were rumpled, especially his shirt, and he had no toothbrush or razor. Well, Planner's Bank would just have to take him unshaven for the first time in his loyal dog's career there. Fuck it. The newspaper had helped. Gave them something to talk about instead of what was on their minds. He had offered to go down to get the newspaper, which was delivered to a box at the bottom of the slope of Martha's big-breasted lawn. But she had said no, she'd better do it. Not that there were what you could really call next-door neighbors in this part of Buckhead. Nevertheless, she had gone down the slope, wearing her striped cotton dress and a pair of navy Belgian slippers, and retrieved the newspaper.
"What's Jordan's opponent? What's his name? André Fleet. What's he have to say about the whole thing?"
At first Peepgas had no idea what Martha was talking about. He had totally forgotten that he had just been talking to her about what the mayor and some councilman had to say about the Elizabeth Armholster business. It took him a moment to sort it out.
"He's not quoted, I don't think," he said.
All at once you could hear laughs, real cackles and deep, deep bassoon belly laughs from Valley Road, at the foot of the lawn. You could hear,
"Hee-hee-hees!" and then a merry contralto voice that sang out, "Who you think's gon' believe that, girlfriend?"
Then more cackles and,
"Hee-hee-hees!"
Peepgas looked quizzically at Martha.
"That's the maids," she said. "They get off the bus down on West Paces Ferry and come walking up the street like a troop."
Peepgas shrugged.
"You think that's what's her name, Carmen?"
"Probably," said Martha, looking at her watch.
That sounded like her. Girlfriend. I hear her saying that on the telephone all the time. It's know-it time, girlfriend. No glove, no love, girlfriend. Peep Gas said, "You want me to go anywhere? I mean, is it okay if she sees me just having breakfast with you like this?" Martha smiled. "I don't think she'll be scandalized, if that's what you mean." "No, I didn't mean... Carmen is ladylike and polite, and I only hear bits and pieces of her conversations. But something tells me she's got a lot going on out in the real world." She smiled again. But she was thinking, "Carmen doesn't matter. But what will people think if I start going around with Mr. Raymond Peepgas? The name is one of those unfortunate names like Cockburn or Hog or Fog. But people soon get over that. I don't dare question him directly about it, but he doesn't seem to have all that important a job at Planner's Bank, although for whatever reason he was important enough for somebody to invite him to the Lapith show, and I know very well how much those table seats cost. Well, I think I could relax with Ray. I don't think he would be very demanding. I don't think he's the type who constantly has to have things whirling and popping the way Charlie was." Then a cloud formed in her frontal lobes. Charlie. Last night, the only way she could go through with it was to visualize that first night with Charlie. She and Nancy King Ambler, everybody called her Nancy King, Southern style, were sharing a one-bedroom apartment on Oakdale Road, near the Emory Medical School. Their agreement was that if either one invited a man up, the other would retire to the bedroom. But it was one of those apartments where you could hear everything, no matter where you retired to. And Nancy King knew very well that this was her first date with the great strapping, handsome, former football hero she had invited up tonight. Martha thought it was a bad idea even to kiss a boy on the first date. But with Charlie, everything had progressed so fast, she could scarcely figure out what was happening. Except that it was all too audible for that apartment, all too full of groans and sighs. And after things had reached a certain point, they were lying on the rug on the floor, she had started saying, "No, Charlie, no," in what she had imagined was a whisper that Nancy King couldn't possibly hear. Then Charlie practically raped her. She couldn't imagine how it had happened. Martha Starling of Richmond, Virginia, going all the way on her first date. Thank God Nancy King was from Tallahassee and didn't know anybody in Richmond. Me, a slut. She was convinced that Charlie Croker would never invite her out again. Instead, he called her the next morning at 8 o'clock. And no matter what Martha Starling's better self thought of what she had done, no matter how much shame flooded her mind, she had a visceral memory of the most intense ecstasy of her life. It was so taboo even to intimate that you could be aroused by male physical power, that she had never said a word about it to anyone, least of all Nancy King. At first neither she nor Nancy King said a thing to each other, aside from good morning and other routine things. Then, just before she left for the medical school, Nancy King said, "Oh, you didn't tell me what you thought of the famous 60-minute man." Her eyebrows were lifted high, and her eyes were wide open, in what Martha took to be an ironic expression. "He was very nice," said Martha, in a tone that precluded any further discussion. She didn't really know Nancy King all that well. And even if she did, how could she possibly describe to her how her smooth, white body had felt last night? That was 33 years ago. But that night, 3 decades ago, was what she had to visualize in order to get through last night with Ray. Charlie had betrayed her in the most egregious way. But she had visualized Charlie last night.
She visualized his massive, muscular body, which had scarcely an extra ounce on it back then. But she had to decapitate him. She couldn't bear to visualize the face behind which he had hidden his perfidy. But for how long would a faceless Charlie Croker from 3 decades ago work for her? The next thing Ray heard was somebody walking across the floor of the entry hall. Then a black woman, Carmen, was in the doorway of the library. She was wearing black jeans with silvery metal studs where the side pockets joined the outseams, a bold yellow T-shirt, and an open black nylon windbreaker with silvery metal snaps down the front and on the sleeves.
"Good morning, Miss Croker."
"Good morning, Carmen," said Martha with considerable gusto. "Carmen, you remember Mr. Peepgas, don't you?" She made it sound as if it were the most ordinary and customary thing in the world to have Mr. Peepgas stay over for breakfast.
"I surely do," said Carmen.
"Nice to see you again," said Peepgas, immediately wondering if he had said the right thing. He was a lot more flustered than Martha, who in fact didn't seem flustered at all. Peepgas gave Martha another once-over. "What is it with me?" he thought. "She's just like Betty. Only she's 4 years older. Another big woman, older than I am, built hefty, who has stronger nerves than I do. Will she be as bossy as Betty? Am I like that character in that book?" He couldn't remember the name of it. "Ivan something. The one where the man gets a second life and helplessly repeats the first one." Roger turned right off of West Paces Ferry and drove his Lexus up to Blackland Road, begrudging Buckhead every last oak, every last maple, every last hickory and sycamore, every last hardwood tree the lawns were blessed with. Hardwood. Smug bastards. Croker had left the hospital, but he returned no telephone calls, neither to his home nor to his office. 2 Federal Express envelopes had brought no replies. West Jordan was putting the pressure on him, and he was here to put it on Croker. God! Croker's house looked like something from out of those movies. A stone wall, a stone courtyard, a stone facade, a quarry's worth of stone for one family to live amid. He pulled right up to the front entrance. Why be diffident? He slammed his car door for emphasis and marched up the 2 little sets of steps that led to the threshold. Because of the angle of the light, it wasn't until he was right at the doorway that he realized that the door itself, a massive thing with raised panels, was open, and only a screen door was between him and his quarry, probably because it was such a cool, dry morning for a change. If the screen door was locked, he'd knock it right out of its slot. He knew how these damned screen door locks were made, even in Buckhead. Couldn't really see inside. Damn screen was like a scrim they use on stage. You can only see what's on the lighted side of the scrim. But then his eyes grew accustomed to the dimness of the entry hall. Christ almighty, it was Croker. He was on his feet, wearing a nightshirt and a blue bathrobe, near as Roger could figure out. Clack, 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 clack. He was supporting himself on a pair of aluminum crutches that clacked and rattled every time they hit the floor. His back was to Roger. He seemed to be heading for that grand staircase, the one that rose up like something from out of a movie. Beside him was some sort of attendant in a white uniform. Roger yelled out, "Mr. Croker?" Croker stopped, but didn't try to look around. The attendant, however, turned about and gave him a squinting look as if to figure out who it could be. Then he leaned in toward Croker and told him something, and Croker said, in a whisper so heavy you could hear it all the way to the front door,
Tell him I'm in the middle of my therapy.
The young man turned toward Roger and said, Mr. Croker's in the middle of his therapy. That made Roger furious. He grasped the screen door handle, prepared to break the lock, and discovered it was not locked at all. So he opened it, and here goes. He stepped inside and started walking across a vast expanse of marble floor. Made him think of his first visit to a Buckhead home, the rendezvous with Farik Fannin at Buck McNutter's.
Mr. Croker, he said sharply. Mr. Croker!
Now the young attendant stepped between Roger and the old man. He stood there with his arms folded over his chest and his legs wide apart in a stance that seemed to say, You're not coming any closer. There was something in the boy's stare that Roger found unnerving, and his arms suddenly looked terribly big. So he didn't try to get any closer. And now Croker was slowly turning about on his crutches. Unlike the boy's, Croker's expression was that of someone who has been whipped and humbled by disease and fate.
I can't talk to you now.
It was far from the Charlie Croker voice of yore.
I've just been through surgery.
Not three syllables, but two. Surgery. It came out not as a statement of fact, but as a plea. It was pathetic. It made Roger bolder than ever.
I don't mean to barge in, said Roger, in a tone that converted it into raillery, meaning, I barged in because I felt like it. But I must have an answer from you. I've called you, I've left innumerable messages, I've faxed you at your office, I've sent you two letters by Federal Express. I don't know of any other way to reach you other than to do what I'm doing right now. This isn't a game, Mr. Croker. Are you going to appear at the press conference, or are you going to let us videotape your statement, or neither? If it's neither, then a lot of things have to be changed, and I think you know one of them.
Croker said,
Well,
and then he seemed to deflate before Roger's very eyes. This is not going to be any ordinary press conference, said Roger. The mayor's going to be there, and it's going to be more like a State of the City address, or a State of Race Relations in Atlanta, than a press conference. I've been assuring him that you'd be there. If you double-cross me and him, it won't be pleasant. That much I can guarantee. With that, he cocked his head and gave Croker the wry look you give some underling who is wavering and quavering in the face of the job he knows he has to do.
Okay, said the old man.
He let his head droop until his chin was on top of his clavicle. He looked like the most thoroughly whipped brute Roger had ever seen. He looked up again, but only long enough to croak out,
I'll be there.
Good, said Roger. I'm glad. I'll take that as a commitment. The mayor's not playing games. There's something dead serious at stake here.
Barely above a whisper, Yeah.
All right, said Roger. It's a commitment. And our other arrangement will remain in place. Roger was now hearing his own words as if he were in a grandstand watching and hearing himself perform in the arena. Had he ever before talked to anyone of this man's stature in such a hectoring, lecturing, patronizing manner? If he had, he couldn't remember it. It was exhilarating. The 60-minute man, Croker the developer, who had helped shape the very skyline of Atlanta, Croker the Croker of Croker Concourse. Goodbye, Mr. Croker. He managed to make that one little word, goodbye, sound like a thoroughly peremptory statement. Croker croaked out an exhausted,
goodbye,
as he turned around to continue his rattling hobble to the staircase. The last thing Roger could hear from inside the great mansion after he went outside, heading for his car, was clack, 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 clack. Conrad felt terribly embarrassed for Mr. Croker. He had just been humiliated by a fancy-dressed black man who came barging into the house as if he owned it. Just like that he had come in. Conrad was too embarrassed for the old man even to ask what it was all about, although he was dying to. Finally, he figured out a way for the old man to tell him, if it suited him. He said,
"Who was that, Mr. Croker?"
"Oh, he's some lawyer," said the old man. "Works for a law firm downtown."
Conrad said nothing, waiting for more, but all he got was the clack, 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 clack of the aluminum crutches as the old man neared the staircase.
"Jesus God," Croker said under his breath, "this thing hurts."
Then directly to Conrad,
"What's going to be the best way for me to do this?"
He motioned with his head toward the stairs.
"These damn staircases look terrific, but every step in the curve is bigger at one end than it is at the other."
Conrad said, "Even so, Mr. Croker, just put your crutches up on the next step and push off your left foot and swing your weight forward. In case anything happens, I'm going to be right behind you." "But nothing's going to happen, Mr. Croker."
"I'm 235 pounds," said Croker. "What are you going to do if I fall backward?"
"But you won't be falling out of a tree, Mr. Croker. You'd be falling at an angle." "When it's at an angle, it isn't so much a matter of size and weight as position, or that's the way it's always seemed to me, Mr. Croker." Gradually, he was able to cajole and jolly the old man up the stairs. He had plenty of strength. He was an ox of a man, and plenty of coordination. But for whatever reason, he didn't want to make the effort. Mr. Croker had decided to move from the library to a guest bedroom. This room, all by itself, was more luxurious than any room Conrad had ever seen in his life. The centerpiece was a big four-poster bed with silk curtains or something, and some sort of frame over the bed, covered in more silk, creating a canopy. At the head of the bed were about a dozen pillows, at least a dozen, from big bolsters up against the headboard to little children's pillows covered with lace and ribbons, and a lot of other things Conrad didn't know the name for. Covering the bed was a white counterpane with all kinds of trimmings. The floor was covered in a wall-to-wall carpet that looked like needlepoint and was designed with flowers, tendrils, leaves, and stems that matched the colors of the silk that hung down the four posts of the bed. There were two easy chairs covered in a striped fabric, and so many curtains on the windows he gave up trying to figure it all out. Croker was panting from the exertion of the climb. His face was red, and there was sweat on his forehead.
"I need to go in there," said the old man, nodding his head toward the bathroom. "I gotta take a shower."
Conrad walked with him as he went, clack, 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 on the aluminum crutches, over to the bathroom door.
"Want me to come in with you?" said Conrad.
"I'll be all right," said the old man.
Mr. Croker went inside and began sighing and clack-clacking, all of which Conrad could hear despite the thick door. Conrad was standing just outside in case the old man needed him. All at once, out of the corner of his eye, he noticed a form in the doorway to the hall. He turned his head, and there for an instant was Mrs. Croker, Serena Croker, wearing nothing but a short silk slip. It barely covered her breasts, whose aureole welled out against the silk, and the hem was somehow tucked between her thighs, creating a shadowy delta beneath her mons veneris. Her black hair was tumbling down over her shoulders. She immediately ducked back from the doorway, and then extended only her head into the opening and said,
"I didn't know you were here. I'm very sorry."
Amazing blue eyes she had. Conrad swallowed and said,
"Mr. Croker's..."
He motioned toward the bathroom. She looked at Conrad for what seemed like several seconds too long, and then pulled her head back and disappeared. A few rogue thoughts bubbled up into Conrad's brain, but he refused to dwell on them. Now Conrad could hear Mr. Crooker calling him from inside the bathroom.
"Connie, give me a hand with this."
Conrad opened the door, and there, on his crutches, was the old man, trying to lean into a shower stall and turn on the water. "Let me help you off with your robe and your nightshirt," said Conrad.
"Oh, yeah," said Crooker.
Conrad slipped the blue robe off, one arm at a time, and then supported Crooker by putting his arm around his waist as he pulled his nightshirt off up over his head. Now the old man stepped out of his slippers, and Conrad steadied him as he hobbled over to the shower stall. Croker's chest, arms, shoulders, and back, especially the back, were massive, and yet the sight was not a picture of power, but of age and decrepitude. The flesh was loose, loose on the bone, grayish, sagging, and nothing was ever going to make it tight again, either. He didn't have a pot belly, but nevertheless the flesh was loose, and it sagged, and his belly button was buried somewhere beneath a 2-inch-wide fold of skin in that loose, sagging old man's flesh.
"I'll never let that happen to me," Conrad vowed to himself.
He had no way of knowing that the old man had made the same vow to himself 37 years ago. With a big helping of moaning, groaning, sighing, and wincing, the old man managed to take his shower, and was more than willing to have Conrad steady him and towel him off afterward. Then he wanted a fresh nightshirt, and so Conrad went into the dressing room, as the old man called it. Conrad had never seen so many closets in one room in his life. It was the size of a living room lined with closets. There was even a delicate little desk, chairs, and lamps. Traces of young Mrs. Croker's perfume hung in the air. So agog was Conrad over life lived in this way, he all but forgot why he was in here. But by and by he found the bureau the old man had told him about. You had to open a pair of louvered maple doors to get to it, and took the nightshirt back to the guest room and helped the old man into it, and then into bed. Just clearing the unnecessary pillows off the bed seemed to take 10 minutes. Conrad said, "You want me to leave you alone, Mr. Crooker, so you can rest?" With a great sigh and without looking at the boy, Charlie said,
"No."
He paused and then looked right at him and then said,
"You got that book with you?"
"You mean the Stoics?" asked the boy.
"Yeah, you got it?"
"Yes, sir, it's down in the library."
"Well, why don't you go get it?"
"Well, yes, sir." The boy went downstairs. Once the boy was out of the room, Charlie pushed himself up toward the head of the bed and propped 2 bolster pillows under his head and neck. He didn't want to be such an invalid in front of the boy. At least now he was sort of halfway sitting up. The boy returned with the book, and Charlie motioned toward an easy chair and said,
"Have a seat. Wait a minute. Close that door over there."
So the boy went over and closed the door to the hall. Then he went back near the bed and sat down in a striped easy chair. Charlie did a double take. It was strange to see him there, this lean, lithe, muscular boy, sinking down into this voluptuous pink and green fleshpot's indulgence of an easy chair.
"The Stoics," said Charlie.
He looked away from the boy and up toward the canopy overhead. All this silk, that and the chair the boy was in, made him realize how many fashionable trifles this house was stuffed with. Then he looked back at the boy and said,
"Tell me about yourself, Connie. Where you from?"
Conrad had known someone would ask him this question sooner or later, and so he was prepared, or so he thought.
"Well, there isn't a whole lot to tell, Mr. Croker.
I'm 23. I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin. He could remember enough of what his parents had mentioned about Madison to get by with anybody who hadn't actually lived there. My mom and dad both went to the University of Wisconsin, and he had an okay job. But when I was 16, things went very bad for him, and I had to drop out of high school and go to work.
What do you mean, things went very bad for him?
He was an alcoholic, Mr. Croker. He just left us. We never heard from him again.
Jesus Christ, said the old man. What kind of job did he have?
He was a dispatcher for a paper products company, a small company.
Paper products?
Yes, sir. I remember they used to make these sort of gray cartons that eggs come in. Conrad figured that paper products and these sort of gray cartons that eggs come in would finish off discussions of his father's curriculum vitae pretty rapidly.
What kind of work could you get at 16?
Bagger and delivery boy for a supermarket.
Your mother couldn't get a job?
No, sir. Or rather, she could, but she couldn't keep one. My mother was not organized. She thought of herself as an artist, and she thought regular jobs were very square. That was a term she used to use, very square. Mom used to be a hippie, an actual hippie. They had hippies in Madison.
Where's your mother now?
She died 3 years ago, from something I'd never heard of before. Tuberculosis of the brain.
Jesus Christ, said Charlie. So you've been completely on your own ever since?
If you really want to know the truth, Mr. Croker, even before then.
What would you like to do, if you had your choice?
Finish college. I finally got my high school equivalency, and I completed my 2 years at a community college. Right now I'm trying to save enough to finish up at a 4-year college and get a degree, Mr. Croker.
How much can you save on this job? Said the old man.
Not much, Mr. Croker, but it'll do for now. And the hours are pretty flexible, so I got plenty of time to look for something that pays better.
Well, hell, maybe I could help you, said Charlie, suddenly excited by the prospect of doing something for the boy.
But then he sighed. His spirits deflated. After laying off 15% of the workforce at Croker Global Foods, it wouldn't be very bright for him to turn around and order them to hire somebody just because he was a nice kid.
No, I don't think we're hiring, and it's a lousy job anyway.
Charlie looked away from the boy as if he had already let him down. Then he turned back toward him.
Tell me something, Connie. Where the hell'd you work to get those arms of yours? He made a gesture toward the boy. And those hands?
That was not a question Conrad had anticipated. His mind spun. The best he could come up with was warehouse work, but he'd changed the industry.
For about 6 months, Mr. Croker, I worked in a wholesale paint warehouse. All day long you'd be lifting cans of paint and drums of spackle and plaster mix that weighed anywhere from 10 pounds to 80 pounds. All day long you were giving your hands and your forearms a workout to the max. That was what one of the fellows I used to work with used to say. To the max.
Uh-huh, said Charlie.
He paused for 5 or 6 seconds, then said,
I can tell you one a lot worse than that.
One what, sir? Said the boy.
A warehouse job, said Charlie. A warehouse job worse than working in a paint warehouse. I own some warehouses myself. Food service warehouses. Wholesale food distribution. Maybe you've seen one of our trucks. They're all over the place. Croker Global Foods is what it says on the side of them. White trucks with navy and gold lettering.
Charlie couldn't figure out what had happened. The boy was speechless. He stared at Charlie blankly, as if all his lights had gone out. So Charlie repeated it in the form of a question.
Have you ever seen our trucks? Kroger Global Foods?
Finally, the boy said,
Yes, I have.
It would be hard to miss 'em, said Charlie. We're all over the country. Anyway, seeing as how we're food distributors, we handle a lot of stuff that's got to be kept frozen, especially meat. So in every warehouse we have a freezer unit about the size of this house. Maybe not quite that big, but big. And we got people who work in there called freeze pickers. They work an 8-hour shift at about 0 Fahrenheit, hauling product off these racks, out of these slots, they call them, 60, 70, 80-pound frozen cartons. Charlie averted his eyes again, lying there, and shook his head. Then he looked at the boy once more. The worst of it is when they come out of the damn things with these icicles coming out of their noses. I'm not kidding. He tossed one hand up in a gesture of helplessness. Out of their noses! Once more he turned away. Jesus! He turned back again. Big sigh. I'd like to sell the whole damn business, but I've borrowed more money against the damn thing than it's worth, if I tried to sell it now. So anyway, you had a job in a paint warehouse. Where was that?
The boy didn't say anything for the longest time. Finally, he said, Milwaukee, Mr. Kroger.
So, how'd you happen to come here?
I'd read there were a lot of jobs available in Atlanta. And there are a lot of jobs available, but they don't pay much unless you're a college graduate.
The old man said, So, when did you get interested in the Stoics?
A few weeks ago. I found this book I showed you in a second-hand store in Chamblee. He held the book up so the old man could see it.
The Stoics, Mr. Kroger said once more. And what was the man's name again? Epictetus?
Epictetus.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, what does Epictetus have to say about bankruptcy? Or is that something too mundane for a philosopher to think about?
Not too mundane for Epictetus, Mr. Kroger. One place he says, You are all nervous and you can't sleep at night for fear you're going to run out of money. You say, How will I even get enough to eat? But what you are really afraid of is not starvation, but the prospect of not having a cook or somebody to wait on you at the dinner table, or somebody to take care of your clothes and your shoes and the laundry, and make up the beds and clean up the house. In other words, you're afraid you may no longer be able to lead the life of an invalid.
He really said that? Asked Charlie. About insomnia and leading the life of an invalid and all that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What else does he say?
He says, Where does your fear of losing your worldly possessions lead you? To death. When Ulysses was shipwrecked and washed up on shore with nothing left, it never broke his spirit. He approached the fix he was in like a hill-bred lion, trusting in his might. He wasn't depending on his reputation, his money, his official position, but on his own might. What makes you free is what's inside you. That's what he says, Mr. Kroger.
Charlie's lame knee wouldn't allow him to roll over in bed, but he twisted his body as best he could, in order to look the boy squarely in the face. This boy declaiming stoicism from the downy billows of an easy chair, custom-made for one of Serena's visions of luxury.
What's he really getting at, this Epictetus?
Well, I'm not the final word on this, Mr. Kroger, but what he's saying, it seems to me, he's saying that the only real possession you'll ever have is your character and your scheme of life, he calls it. Zeus has given every person a spark from his own divinity, and no one can take that away from you, not even Zeus. And from that spark comes your character. Everything else is temporary and worthless in the long run, your body included. You know what he calls your possessions? Trifles.
You know what he calls the human body? A vessel of clay containing a quart of blood. If you understand that, you won't moan and groan. You won't complain. You won't blame other people for your troubles. And you won't go around flattering people. I think that's what he's saying, Mr. Croker. Charlie said, "He talked about flattering people?" That caught his attention. The lies he had agreed to recite about Farik Fanon were flattery elevated to some sort of ultimate. "Yes, sir," said the boy, "that's what he said. The flatterer debases himself and deceives the object of his fawning. Dogs fawn over one another, he says, but throw a piece of meat between them and see how much friendship remains." For a moment, Charlie tried to fit the piece of meat into his own relationship with Farik Fanon, but he couldn't come up with any real analogy. Then he said to the boy, "Let me ask you this. What would Epictetus say if a man made a speech praising a prominent public figure, okay? And he did admire the man's power and skill in his line of work. But he didn't think much of him as a person. Would it be okay to make the speech, as long as you stuck pretty much to the man's professional life when you gave the talk? Is this someone the person giving the talk truly does not like?" Charlie paused, sighed, let out his breath, and said dejectedly, "Yeah, he can't stand the son of a bitch." "Is the person giving the speech praising this public figure with the idea of gaining something for himself?" The old man hesitated for a moment, then said, "Yeah, you got it." "Not much, then," said the boy. "Epictetus says that selling out lowers you to the level of a beast, like the wolf or the fox. For some reason, he thought that foxes were the lowest of all." "He actually says, selling out?" "Practically," said the boy. "Let me see." He thumbed through the book. "Here it is, Book 1, Chapter 2. He says, 'Of one thing beware, O man. See what is the price at which you sell your will. If you do nothing else, do not sell your will cheap.'" The old man said, "How do you know whether you're selling out too cheap or not?" "If you're selling out at all, it's too cheap," said Conrad. "Or at least that's the way I interpret what he's saying, Mr. Croker, since the true Stoic makes no compromises. Selling out and compromises are not part of his character." "Well, that's fine," said Charlie, "but how do you know what your character is? Well, let's say there's a crisis you've got to deal with. How do you know what you're really made of?"
"Epictetus talks about that," said Conrad. "He says, 'How does a bull, when a lion's coming after him, and he has to protect the whole herd, how does he know what powers he's got? He knows because it has taken him a long time to become powerful. Like the bull, a man doesn't become heroic all of a sudden either. Epictetus says, he must train through the winter and make ready.'"
"Like a bull."
"Jesus Christ," thought Charlie. "Of all the animals he could have chosen, he has to pick out the bull." The old folk song started ricocheting around in his skull so fast he couldn't get rid of it. "Charlie Croker was a man in full. He had a back like a Jersey bull. Didn't like okra, didn't like pears. He liked a gal that had no hairs. Charlie Croker, Charlie Croker, Charlie Croker." "Like a Jersey bull." It was as if the boy, this Connie, could read his mind and knew exactly how to prod him, Charlie Croker, he who would compare himself to a Jersey bull.
"This is all very noble," said Charlie, "in the abstract, all this your man is saying. But what does it have to do with real life? Let's think about real life for a second. Let's think about a situation in which you lose everything. You lose everything. You see what I'm saying? You lose everything. The house where you live, your income, your cars, everything. You're out on the street. You don't know where your next meal's coming from. What good do a lot of high-sounding ideals mean then?
The boy said, many of Epictetus' disciples asked him that exact same thing. And you know what he told them?
No, what?
Have you ever seen an old beggar? The kid's eyes were boring right into him.
You're asking me?
Yes.
Sure I have, said Charlie. Plenty of them.
See?
They've gotten by, said the boy. They've managed to get food to eat 365 days a year, probably. They're not starving.
What makes you think they can all find food and you wouldn't be able to?
What kind of consolation is that supposed to be? I'd rather die than go around with a cup in my hand.
The boy smiled and his eyes brightened. Epictetus talks about exactly that, Mr. Croker. He says, you're not afraid of starving. You're afraid of losing face. He says, you don't have to have some high position before you can be a great man. One of the great Stoic philosophers, Cleanthes, hauled water to make a living. He was a day laborer, Mr. Croker. But nobody thought of him as someone who didn't have a respectable job. Why? Because he radiated the power of the spark of Zeus. Charlie closed his eyes and tried to imagine it. He's out on the street. What street? Blackland Road? All he'd get there would be an occasional puff of BMW fumes or a piece of gravel dislodged from a tire tread.
So where? Peachtree Street? Nobody even walks on Peachtree Street. And so who's going to stop his Mercedes or Infinity to give Charlie Croker a quarter? Maybe he could take his tin cup into the parking lot at the Lenox Square Mall. But they've probably got security personnel to chase hooples who come wandering in on foot out of there before they can hunker down on the pavement and set out their cup and a sign saying, please help me. Need $28 more so I can get back home to Mobile. No advice, enlightenment, or root causes conversations, please. That was a sign Charlie had seen in... where the hell was it? Lenox Square? Downtown near the CNN building? Charlie looked at the boy, Connie, and shook his head and said,
I've tried, but I just can't see it.
And yet, if it happened, said the boy, it wouldn't be nearly as bad as you think, Mr. Croker. Epictetus would say that you—I'm just saying this for the sake of argument, Mr. Croker— Epictetus would say you've given way to your animal impulses, and think of yourself as all belly and flesh and animal desire, at the expense of that which Zeus has given you, that spark of the divine. There was a knock on the door, and then it opened. It was Serena, with a cross between anger and fear on her face. She wore a plain periwinkle blue sundress that was demure in concept, but showed plenty of her bosom. Her thick black hair seemed to be tumbling down in waves, and her eyes were all the more vivid because they matched her dress. She came toward the bed, saying, Charlie, who is this man White? He's... Charlie cut her off.
Serena, you remember Connie, don't you?
It seemed terribly important, somehow, that she acknowledge the boy's presence. She turned her head distractedly toward the boy, who by now had risen to his feet, and she said,
Oh, yes, of course.
Then she turned back toward Charlie.
This Mr. White, he keeps calling, and he keeps saying he wants to reconfirm your decision. Reconfirm your decision, he keeps saying, and he doesn't care who he's talking to, Germaine, Nina, anybody. What are we supposed to do about him? What's this all about?
Charlie felt terribly embarrassed that she should be bringing all this up in front of Connie. He wanted to put her in her place, but he felt so tired, so vulnerable. He felt as if he were sinking into the mattress, into the sanctuary of this bed with its thousands of dollars' worth of fabric billowing down the four posters. There, 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 and there. He was living the life of an invalid, just as Epictetus had said. And what was the name of the guy? Cleanthes? He hauled water for a living, just like some wage mule's work. And he was still a great man, and everybody knew it. Well, said Serena, who now actually had her hands on her hips. Her eyes were blazing. What do we do about him? Charlie pushed himself up by pressing the heels of his hands into the mattress, so that he was at least halfway sitting, and not such an invalid. You're right, he said to Serena. So far I've been a fox, but it's against my nature. I feel lousy, and my knee hurts like hell, but I'm going to be a bull. I'll deal with it. Withering scorn. What on earth are you talking about, Charlie, a fox and a bull? Charlie realized he certainly didn't sound like a bull. His voice was barely above the level and vitality of a croak, and nowhere in himself could he find the will to even